Like you said, I love sales. I came from sales. Maybe it's because I feel still connected to sales that I'm like, I can say it, but like I've sent my fair share of one pagers, you know? But back in the day when I'm sending those things, would I have rather sent a really good dynamic web page that's like trackable and has video or interactive product tours or like customer stories that we can swap in and out? Like totally. So that's like the TLDR on that like take is basically, what can a one pager do that a web page can't do? And so that's been another shield I have. I'm just like, let's just try our best to always say website over one pagers. If you need something that a one pager could do, let's just make sure the website does that, you know? And so it can serve so many more people.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Product Marketing Life Podcast, the show where we sit down with everyday product marketers to talk life, career, and most importantly, product marketing. My name is Colin Majak, the APMM at Classy from GoFundMe. And today I got a chance to sit down with my friend Logan Hendrickson. Now, if you don't know Logan, Logan is the lead product marketing manager at 15five. And in this episode, we got a chance to talk about Logan's path from sales to product marketing, breaking out of the slide deck rut that so many PMMs find themselves in with sales, why you should stop making one pagers, and how passion projects will make you a better PMM. I really enjoyed this conversation with Logan, and I think you will too. Enjoy the episode. Logan, dude, it is so good to have you on the podcast. How are you?
Good, man. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat.
So for people who don't know you, you're currently a product marketing lead at 15five. But if I remember correctly, you came up through sales, right? Could you paint a little bit of a picture of how you made that jump from sales to PMM?
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, outside of a few internships, my first real like business experience was being an SDR, and especially like B2B SaaS, like being an SDR. And I'm like old. It's kind of crazy. You have to like say this now, but it's like, that's back when SDRs were humans, you know, and not like AI robots.
Yeah.
And it's when we would make a bunch of phone calls. Like email was secondary. Email was once they're in the pipeline.
Okay.
So I spent just a ton of time calling people, and I am an introvert and a relatively like quiet person. But I got good at sales because basically I had a really good boss. And long story short, like I spent 5 years, I was an SDR for a short bit. I spent like 5 years as an AE, a couple different startups. And then how I made the jump was honestly like, I'm at a company, they post, hey, we're going to hire for this product marketing thing. Like go share it on LinkedIn. So I read it and then I'm like, wait, is this a job? I had no idea what product marketing was. And just all the stuff, I was like, this sounds awesome. Like I didn't know there was one person who could do exactly this other than the head of PMM at the time was like highly visible, always making cool stuff.
Yeah.
And so I just talked to him and I was like, Jason? Hey, it was Jason. Yeah. Okay. Jason Oakley.
What a dream gig to stumble into, just for context.
Oh my gosh. Jason is, we could talk the whole time about how awesome he is at his job and how just a great, kind Canadian he is.
One of the kindest, for sure.
Yeah. And honestly, so then I was like, hey, Jason, this looks cool. There's like a project part of the application. And like, I was earnestly like, could I just do this project to see what it's like? You give me feedback. And then maybe 5 years down the road, this is like what I'll do after I'm done being in sales.
Yeah.
So he said, yeah. And then he thought the project was good. And then it just happened fast and they offered me a job. And I was like, it was hard to be honest. The hardest part was leaving like variable comp of sales.
Yeah.
Like it's pretty fun to get occasional big commission checks. Uh-huh. But then after that, I like haven't looked back. It's been a perfect fit. It's way more aligned to like my natural skills and my personality. And yeah, I love it. So it's a super good foundation to start from. I honestly think I used to say it's like the best place, like be a salesperson first, but now it's such, I think it's such a well-rounded career that like you can have a lot of good entry points.
Yeah, I share some commonalities in your experience in that I was a project manager on a marketing team, and a role came on my radar for a product marketing manager role at a different company. And at the time I had in my mind, oh, I think I want to make the jump to marketing sometime in the next couple years. Like I'll stay over here as a project manager. I'll get more exposure to marketing and how you take products to market and all that. And I remember I had a buddy of mine who, you know, those people you end up graduating high school with who are just freakishly smart and are way ahead of their career than they should be for their age. He's one of those. So he was, I think, a VP of marketing by like 27. And he was like, why aren't you just making the jump sooner? Why not make the jump to marketing now? And that kind of gave me the courage to apply and just try it. But I resonate specifically with that feeling of, oh, I might eventually do this. I'm in a path right now that's not product marketing. That seems interesting. Maybe I'll make that jump. And then kind of having an inciting incident to say, I'm just going to put myself out there. And then ultimately I got the job because I knew that customer base. I imagine the same thing was true with you of like going from AE to PMM internally. So I've heard that take that sales is perhaps one of the best backgrounds you can have for product marketing. I would be curious how you feel like that background has changed how you do product marketing.
I'd say it's a really strong background for anyone trying to get into product marketing, especially if it's at the company you're already at, yeah, or like you, like the same industry. Because then it's such a competitive advantage to be like, I literally can sell this product. Like, yeah, you can see how many times I've sold this. So like, then you can easily be like, I can sell it. And let me like scale those selling skills to everybody. I think it's changed. That's kind of one thing, is like viewing it as sales at scale, which is kind of like a cliche 100%. About marketing in general, but it is what it is. It's like, I think we're always selling, we're always being sold to. Messaging is just like, when you're in sales, messaging is just like what you say on a call
100%.
Or what you type on an email. And so it's like, cool. That's like part of what you already do, what I already did, what I was good at. And now I can just tweak the message to where it's kind of like applies to everyone instead of just Mr. or Mrs. Prospect. Yeah. And so that's kind of how, obviously the more sort of standard is like, now you're good at sales enablement, you know? So it's like, I don't love sales enablement as much, maybe because of that. It's like not my favorite part of the job. It's because I'm kind of like, that was what I did the best and what I did for the most. And it's just because I could just say, listen, I already speak the language of sales. You know? Like they'll trust me. I'm one of them. Uh-huh. And maybe I don't like it as much because I'm less one of them anymore. I don't know.
Yeah. That's really interesting that coming from sales, you've now kind of had this, how do I say this? Hesitancy to go full sprint into sales enablement, kind of knowing that world. I would be curious to get your thoughts on this because there's kind of a dysfunction between the PMM and sales relationship that I've observed. And it's this rut that product marketers get into of just asset request fulfillment. So like sales reaches out, hey, I need this asset, and PMM is expected to churn it out. So you want a deck? Okay, you got it. You need a one pager? I'm on it. And I think a lot of PMMs are exhausted by a sales relationship that looks like that. So I would just be curious, coming from sales and leading product marketing now, I want your take. What do you think the relationship between product marketing and sales should look like? If it's not asset requests, what should we be actually doing for sales?
Yeah, it's a good question. Sales matter a lot, you know? So we want our business to sell more stuff all the time. I think my initial reaction to that is probably maybe not what you think. Like, I actually am not that opposed to like a creative request process, like sort of operating like a little consultancy or agency that's embedded in the org, and similar, like in our org right now, we operate like that with PMM a little bit. I'm like starting it, but we operate it for sure with creative stuff. Yeah. You know, it's like submit a creative brief and then it goes into the queue. And then it's kind of like a, you know, roadmap feature request voting tool, or it's like an Asana board. And it's just like, once you put your request in there, you can see this is in the backlog, or this is being like in triage, or this is, we're waiting to see how many upvotes this gets before we go do it. And so I actually like that process, and it gets you away from the random Slack messages like, hey, I need this thing yesterday. But it still gives sales like an official avenue to make requests, so they feel like they're being heard, so they feel like they know, okay, they know that we need this.
Yeah.
And then if you really need it, then kind of make the case for it. And it also like, it makes it easy for you to coach and teach people how to make those requests, because like what we have is very tactically, it's like a form in Asana. How impactful will this be? How much revenue is attached? Is there a renewal on the line? When do you need it by? What have you tried before that we have that isn't working?
Yeah.
And it's like, cool. If they're willing to put that work into it, then
they want it.
It matters. And it's not just like, I need more case studies all the time. So yeah, that's kind of my take. I mean, we do that for product launches too. It's kind of like the PM fills out a similar form. And so I think I kind of like that approach, and it is asset requesting sort of, but it's also like, how much skin in the game do you have? How willing are you to like put in the effort to ask for this? And then we can have go back and forth after that.
Yeah, I would be curious, when those requests come through to your team, and I imagine you guys are analyzing, all right, let's say hypothetically, we've got a request for two different decks, one case study, and this one pager. I would be curious, how does your team, beyond the, okay, they felt they took the time to show it's important. I would be curious, like, how do you prioritize what actually gets attention? One. And then two, is there any time where you just point back to something that already exists? So like, just thinking like, all right, from your team side, like the team, your sales is going to churn these in, and you could do like a first in, first out, but I have to imagine there's more prioritization than that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's stuff in there that we're just like, we aren't going to do this. So I appreciate it. I mean, you have to do it tactfully, and you sometimes have to get your boss to tell their boss or whatever, you know,
the but boss it's telephone. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, we aren't going to do this. Here's why. The helpful reasons are like, we have one strategic vision. We have like three company level OKRs, you know, we know exactly who our ICP is, and we know exactly who people who love to buy our product but aren't our ICP. And so it's like, who is this for? Is this serving the kind of greater purpose of all these other goals? Like, and yeah, there's times when you're like, hey, we have a case study that kind of says this similar thing. Here's a friendly reminder in case you forgot. And like, is this still something that you need? It's tricky. I wouldn't say the list for us right now is like massive, so we can address each one, but I would say it's just like any other prioritization is like, at the end of the day, if we zoom all the way out, it's going to actually help us hit the company level goals that we have all equally signed up for, which is easier said than done, and like not a specific example, you know, it's like way harder when it's like, yeah, but I need this exact case study to close this exact deal.
Yeah.
And you're saying no, like that's when it gets actually hard.
Yeah. That seems to be a rut that comes up the most in enterprise deals. I don't know if that's been your experience, but for me, I feel like whenever there's an enterprise deal on the line, it's almost like there's this threat level midnight urgency to, hey, an asset's coming in, can you please make this? And they're not respecting the Asana task list. It's a Slack message where they've tagged their boss and that sort of thing. And I imagine from a leadership standpoint, like if you're leading people and they come to you and say, hey, I've got this request for this deck for this one specific deal, like it's not going to affect other deals. Being able to ladder that up into, hey, does this match against our top three OKRs as kind of like a shield of like, does this actually fit that? And obviously, I mean, I are on the side of, I want to deliver assets where I can, like I want to be that team player. Cause a lot of times you come through with that one or two times in sales, loves you, and that's like a worthwhile thing to do. But there is a balance to toe, lest you become kind of the asset fulfillment monkey.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody told me a story recently where they literally called, I won't even say the name, but it's a similar to what you just said, a little more vulgar version of that's like what they called their product marketer. And it's like, you don't want to be that, you know? But there's also like, I don't know, if you're a product manager and then the biggest customer who like makes or breaks your year asks for a specific feature, there are times when it's like, you throw out the roadmap and you build the feature.
Yeah.
So that happens for us too.
Yeah, that's so complicated. I was talking to an account executive on a plane this past week, and we talked about this tendency of SaaS companies in particular to when one of their enterprise customers says, "Hey, can you build this feature?" They feel like this immediate pressure of I have to respond to it and I have to make this feature almost. And the risk you run, as I see it, is the tail starts to wag the dog, where instead of actually casting a vision for like, this is what the product should be, this is where it should go. Enterprise, like the enterprise deal kind of runs everything. And that works if you're an enterprise company and you have the bandwidth to do it. But I feel like a lot of companies are really truly a better fit for mid-market, particularly if you're a platform. And you get trapped in the cycle of trying to please a handful of clients because they're a big deal. Do you notice that trend at all?
Yeah. I mean, I do think it wildly depends on like your stage of business, and kind of like the devil's advocate to that is if you're early and you're building what your customers actually want, you know, if you can vet that and be like, oh, like maybe we thought you wanted this, but you're saying you want this. Like, I'm not a product leader, but there's something to be said. It's like, maybe we should build what our customers actually want.
Yeah.
You know, there's for sure the flip side of like, we chase this flashy feature. And then we just have a bunch of features that don't like go together.
Yeah.
So
or they work for one customer rather than multiple. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as long as you're like, everyone is kind of rowing in the same direction, then you have like one sort of super team that goes out and builds this thing for them and then kind of makes it fit back into the way you're headed. But that's like out of my area of expertise.
Yeah. On the note of sales assets, I want to come back to a little bit that relationship. You had a take recently that I loved, but could put you at odds with some sales folks. And it was that you were starting a campaign to kill one pagers. I love that. I love that campaign. And probably a lot of product marketers love that campaign. But this has kind of been taken as the status quo. Like anytime there's a new feature, build a one pager. Anytime there's a new product, build a one pager. I would be curious, can you unpack why you think PMM should stop making one pagers?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the status quo. Like, I feel like there's products built to solve the main problems that we create for ourselves for making a bunch of one pagers, which maybe I'll get to when I'm talking about this. But it's like, like you said, I love sales. I came from sales. Maybe it's because I feel still connected to sales that I'm like, I can say it, but like I've sent my fair share of one pagers, you know, but back in the day when I'm sending those things, would I have rather sent a really good dynamic web page that's like trackable and has video or interactive product tours or like customer stories that we can swap in and out? Like, totally. So that's like the TLDR on that like take is basically, what can a one pager do that a web page can't do? And so that's been another shield I have.
Yeah.
I'm just like, let's just try our best to always say website over one pagers. If you need something that a one pager could do, let's just make sure the website does that, you know? And so it can serve so many more people. And I think there's a couple reasons. Like, it should be, your website should be your best asset. And one pagers end up basically becoming like, I don't know, just a slightly different version of your website.
Yeah.
It's like usually they're the same pictures and words even. I don't know what the difference is other than you can print it.
Yeah.
And your messaging shouldn't be that different, I don't think. Like, you could argue that the website's more top of funnel and then the one pagers are way more like detailed. And sure, if you worked at like a super, super technical thing, there's like white papers that matter,
yeah,
that are like, let's dive into the weeds of the API and all that stuff. But it's like, that's kind of it. I feel like unless you're going to print it and put it on a booth, let's just put it on the website and set.
Yeah, I think it seems to me that the printing use case is the only one I can think of. And I don't even know if anyone's doing that anymore. Maybe depending on your industry. Like, we're talking before this call about like more serving more of a, call it boring industry, where things are, processes are not the same as tech. Everyone's not remote. Like, that printed use case could certainly be an option. But even the niche, like the really detailed white paper use case, most of them you can fulfill that with a knowledge article or a help article or something that still lives with a digital footprint rather than a PDF.
Yeah, I find that you like, I don't know, salespeople want them, rightfully so, maybe just because it's like, I'm used to doing this, and they want to forward it to their buyer or their champion because they think their champion will forward it to the buyer or something.
Yeah.
And maybe they're less likely to do that with a link. And like, the CEO is like, I'm too busy to go to a website. Just put a PDF in my inbox.
Yeah.
But I don't know how real that is.
I think part of it, you're tapping into two things. I think one, there's like an emotional support aspect of it. Like, this is my emotional support one pager. I need this one pager to feel like I'm doing my job following up with this prospect. But I also do think that idea of the busy CEO who is the like final decision maker, or busy CFO, whoever it is, busy decision maker who just doesn't have time to view a page. There might be something to that. I've not actually encountered that as a real thing, but I think that's probably also partially animating this one pager idea of like, oh, if it's in one page, it's simpler.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Colin, do you make one pagers?
I made a one pager for my last launch. And my hunch is that it has not been used since then. I can tell you the main bullet points on that one pager, same copy as is on the corresponding product page. We could just send someone there.
And what's,
I mean, you take out the nav.
Exactly. Are they that?
Like, you get the nav out of there. You take out all the footers. Like, there's some visual simplicity there. But the copy is all the same. And on the flip side of that argument for simplicity, like, you could argue like, oh yeah, keep their focus in one spot. The flip side of that argument is like, create a journey where someone can continue to educate themselves in other areas of your product. And if they're on your site, that's the best place to do that. They could start with this area of the product and go on a fun little click journey and be educating themselves in a way that one pager ends.
Right. And not to mention the, like, I mentioned it, but like, have a self-guided product tour on that one pager. That's impossible.
Yeah.
But those are starting to become expected in a lot of industries where people can buy stuff themselves and not have to talk to people. So yeah, that is interesting. And you also made a good point where you're like, I have a hunch no one's used it. And it's like, you can't tell because I don't know
for sure.
But there are, I mean, I know somebody could say there are tools that track that, like sales enablement tools or whatever. Like, but there's also, it's a lot more simple to just track a link.
Yeah. But like, tools like Nevatic and Turial, if you want to go on the sort of guided tour side of things. And then, pages, just knowing overall the traffic to a page. It might be hard to tell if it's specifically from sales unless you gave a different URL. So that's one thing to consider. It could be hard to know that the source of that traffic. But still, that seems like a worthwhile trade-off of not building something that goes into the void versus something that can live on your site.
I feel like we could go back and forth and I could find the flip side. Cause then the last thing I'll say is somebody could also be like, yeah, but if it's the same as your website, how hard is it really to just make it? Just make it, you know?
Yeah. I will say my last one pager took me 20 minutes, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
It's real quick. It took very little effort. And so,
if that helps one salesperson, and that's because,
I didn't create something new.
That's worth, you know what I mean? So kind of arguing against myself, but
I think, well, right now I think I'll put it in my shoes. Cause I think when the one pager request came through, I initially thought like, this is not needed. I don't need this. But there are so many other things in our go-to-market motion that I would, or let me put it, there are so many other hills that I would rather die on that the one-pager hill was not one I was really willing to fight for. There are other ones that it's like, hey, these are time sucks that just kind of come through automatically. Like if it were a deck is more complicated. There's other things that are more complicated. Yeah. But no, I agree. If you're at the stage of maturity where there are not more important hills to die on, you can axe the one pager. Yeah. Now, something else that sales often comes to PMM for is competitive intel. And in most orgs, unless you have dedicated headcount for competitive, sales is coming to product marketing for competitive intel. And I find myself all the time getting pulled into deals like, hey, what do we know about competitor X? Or what would you say to someone that's evaluating us against competitor Y? Or why is our feature better than feature X at this company? But you've told me that PMM at 15.5 doesn't own competitive. So I'd be curious, how does that work? And what does competitive actually look like then at 15.5?
Yeah. I would say yes, PMM doesn't own it. But that's because in an okay way, in my opinion, no one really owns it. Like, we've tried our best to democratize competitive. We want, in my opinion, I want like the assets to be the source of truth, not a specific person or team, where it's like the knowledge matters, but not like I need Colin on my sales call or I'm not going to, you know, like I don't want to rely on the PMM team. So everyone gets to contribute to the intel. And then we just like tactically have a Slack channel for people to pop things into all the time. And we just like, to be fair, I don't think it's been super formalized. It just sort of like happens where we've got different teams sort of play different roles. We've got a partnerships team. They are like the ear to the ground. They are the ones that they're talking to our competitors and all of our partners who are partners with our competitors. And, you know, like they know everything that's going on. So like they are feeding the flywheel, so to speak. And then, PMM acts as like the asset sort of collectors and then organizers and then distributors. And then product too is like, product does so much. Our industry has a couple of really key competitors. And so like, we don't have to deal with like tons of different people. So it's like, our whole business, our radar is on like these two or three competitors. It's just sort of worked out that way where I'm thankful for it because in product marketing land, we get to, competitive can take a ton of time, you know? And so we get to focus on being, the distributors of that knowledge and not necessarily like going out and trying to find it and make sure we always know everything. We just want to make sure everyone knows as much as possible.
Yeah. One connection you made for me that I haven't thought of is really leveraging if you have someone in your organization who's doing partnerships, leveraging them as your ear to the ground. That's a really helpful takeaway for me because I could think of two people on my partnerships team who are constantly talking to our competitors and those who integrate with us, who also integrate with our competitors. Mm-hmm. And they really are such a goldmine of information, but because they're not product marketing, they don't tend to get thought of as, that person is a source of competitive intel. When in reality, they probably get the clearest distinction on like where our product ends and another product begins.
Yeah. And they might not,
more than just
might not have the mind frame of a good PMM of like, I have this information and now I can like put that into differentiator bullet points for you, you know, but
yes,
they have all of it, you know, like, maybe they can distill some of that for you and then you can map that to what you know about our product, what you know about their product. It's true. Like they're the friendliest faces to the competitors too. Like they're the most likely to get the secret stuff, you know?
Yeah. And they tend to be quite friendly people. Literally. Like, I feel like most of the partnerships people I know are like warm, nice people.
They're at our partnerships teams, like they're at events all the time and they're just like taking selfies, best friends with everybody. So it's so true.
Yeah, with the competitors. And you would never know that they're going to bring back that intel to me so I can inform the roadmap so we can crush
these competitors. Exactly. So we can steal their customers.
So before we wrap, this is super helpful just thinking about that sales relationship. And I think you have a unique vantage point, someone who kind of came up through that, through sales and then made the jump to PMM. But before we wrap, I want to talk about passion projects. And this is a little bit of an aside, but I think there's a lot of pressure on LinkedIn to have a side hustle, something that you can make money off of. But I feel like there's a lot less encouragement of just having passion projects or hobbies. It seems like everything needs to be monetizable to have value. Yeah. But both you and I have passion projects that, as far as I know, we make no money off of. I know I make no money. So I host a podcast on career transitions, not this one. It's for former church workers. And you write a blog on prayer. And so I would be curious, I mean, kind of in an environment where there's so much pressure to like side hustle, monetize, that sort of thing. What made you initially choose a passion project instead of a side hustle at this stage of your career?
I love this question. I will say, first of all, we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but there is for sure value in a side hustle where you're trying to make money as a PMM. So like,
objectively.
Yeah, I think that's a worthwhile for people listening. Like, try to do that, you know, at some point, even if it's just barely, you learn.
Yeah.
Like the one thing I've learned from trying other things in the past or helping other people with their side projects is like buying products. Like, I don't know how many products you buy for your podcast, but I'm trying not to spend any money on my passion project that makes no money. So I'm not like buying new tools or like sitting on demos. But when you do, I've learned a ton just like onboarding with new products I've bought and stuff. Passion projects for sure. Learn a ton. Like the number one, I mean, unless I can't imagine you would do a passion project that's like in the world of your work. But maybe somebody is and could do that out there. But for me, the big like draw is getting my head out of the echo chamber that is my product, my ICP, the category, the industry, and almost seeing what like the digital world is like in another place, like what the marketing land is like elsewhere. And then for me, the other like reason is kind of just like it's personal. I decided to I wanted to like inject a little bit of like life-giving content into the world. And we don't need more content at all. Like, no, there's a lot of content out there. But most
said two guys on the podcast.
But this is
don't even
this
listen.
Is why
you can
no,
stop
keep
now.
Listening. Because I do think that like a lot of that content is what I would just broadly categorize as like not life-giving, like life sucking, you know, like even on LinkedIn, it's like, it's going to lead to comparison or pride, or it's going to compare to whatever the emotion that doom scrolling is for you. But when you're doing like a passion project thing, I don't know, you're not in it for the money. So you're in it just to like, for me, I just want to put some stuff out there that's like, if one person reads this, it's going to like counteract some of that not terrible, but just like not that life-giving stuff out there. So that's like, that's the beginning. That's kind of why it's very specific to what you're doing. But if it's like, you know, for me, spiritual or like creative or whatever, it's usually for yourself a little bit. And so the people who you're making it for will probably resonate with that same thing.
Yeah, I share a lot of that in that I started this passion project in a lot of ways to kind of process my own transition with my career. And turned out it kind of was helping other people do that. So I think I can see a lot of where it's like, hey, I just have skin in the game because this is for me too. Like, this is something that I feel connected to and I feel a draw to. And I think something you hinted at was just this idea that it teaches you things about product marketing that you can bring back to product marketing. And so for me, like I've started this project, I kind of learned like, all right, what does it look like to build an audience and establish a brand and kind of position this podcast and say who it's for and build all this messaging around it and then launch it. So I would be curious if you could, if you think about one thing you've learned about product marketing, despite your passion project not being tied to what you do, not being tied to your customer base, what do you think is something that you've learned from that that has made you maybe a better product marketer?
Yeah, I mean, sort of the value of how to get someone's, how to get the right person's attention. You know, like building something from scratch when you have, you don't have money for LinkedIn ads or another department of people giving you the right person to like go after or whatever. So it is, it's kind of about messaging and positioning and like creating, I don't know if you resonate with this at all, but like when it's not like you are your persona of your side project. Right. You know, so I'm, mine is very like everyone could be the persona or it's like, it's just a human being. Like is, if this resonates with you when you read it sort of thing. So it just helps kind of like define a persona in a more real way. Whereas like when it's like, I have to just get my mind into the buyer of like an HR leader at a B2B tech company who has this many, whatever. It's a little more robotic, but then when you do that same sort of process that you've learned for yourself or for someone where you're like, I actually know these people, like, and I actually really believe in the product, then it's easy for me to put all that back onto the HR person and be like, oh, I actually like, I could know this person and the thing we sell them could actually like really help them with, I don't know. It's like kind of creates empathy in an interesting way. Those are the first two things that come to mind.
Yeah, that's super helpful. I imagine, I think this, that's totally true. For me, it has given me a taste of what it, how far you can get if you really understand and empathize with your customer or audience or whoever it may be. For me, it's an ideal listener. But knowing, all right, actually, if you really get them, reaching them is not as hard.
Yeah.
Like if you really get them, putting a product in front of them that they're interested in, not as hard. Just because it comes out of this real knowledge. That's a super helpful takeaway.
That is good. I feel like you can downplay the research stuff in product marketing sometimes. It's like, how much do we really need to research our personas? Like we've done it. We have the deck. Let's just go. Uh-huh. But I feel like it's a helpful reminder, like, actually, sometimes it's good to slow down and like, let's check ourselves. Do we really know them? Like, or do we like going back to the very beginning, like, are we putting out into the world what we want them to be like instead of what they actually are?
Well, Logan, this was a lot of fun. Thank you for making the time. If people want to keep up with you and kind of what you're up to, you've been putting out a lot of video content lately, which I've really enjoyed. Where can they do that?
Yeah. I mean, LinkedIn, the place that I say you go to find the life-sucking content, I'm one of those people. I do think that there's a lot of good out there in LinkedIn, and I'm trying to be one of those people in a small way, and Colin, you are one of those people. You're like why I think LinkedIn is still worth going on to, so that's it, just there.
Wow, what a compliment. That's a very kind compliment. So, all right, yes, I can affirm Logan's a great follow, but... Dude, thank you again for making the time, and we'll chat soon.
Thanks, man. See ya.
For everyone still tuned in, thanks so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please help us spread the word to other product marketers. Talk to you again and have a great morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are.